I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 199 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, as Hank Neuberger just did, please go to caropop.com. Thanks, Hank. One of my favorite bands, Camper Van Beethoven, played at Riot Fest last month in Chicago, but because they had only a half-hour slot, that wasn't enough for me. So instead, I flew out to Washington, D.C. to see Camper Van Beethoven play the last show of its tour the following night at the 930 Club. Camper frontman David Lowery had said that given the logistical and financial challenges of taking this band on the road, this might be Camper's final show altogether. For one, violinist, multi-instrumentalist Jonathan Siegel lives in Sweden. For two, drummer Chris Peterson lives in Australia. For three, touring a band is expensive even without those extra hurdles, which is why, in recent years, Camper often would tour with and open for Lowry's other band, Cracker. Anyway, the trip to D.C. was totally worth it. The classic Camper Van Beethoven lineup, including multi-instrumentalist Chris Mulla, who'd left after the self-titled third album, played their 40-year-old debut album, Telephone Free Landslide Victory, in full. Then they dove into the subsequent albums up through 1989's Key Lime Pie, the last one before a bitter breakup ended the band's first phase.
He left his baby at the dance hall. While the band plays on some sweet song.
This show brought back the thrill of seeing great musicians play songs you love with telepathic togetherness. One thing I've enjoyed about the Camper reunion shows is Jonathan Siegel adding the spark of his violin playing to Key Lime Pie songs such as Sweethearts, All Her Favorite Fruit, and the band's cover of Status Quo's Pictures of Matchstick Men. Siegel isn't on that album, having left Camper following the tour supporting the band's major label debut, our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart. It wasn't a happy parting, and Siegel recalls here what happened, as well as how he and David Lowery reconciled years later. Siegel also reflects on being born in Marseille, France, growing up in Davis, California, learning how to play violin and guitar as he does, and joining Camper Van Beethoven. He describes the creative dynamic and his place in it, including his writing of songs such as Still Wishing a Chorus,
pushing in the nightmare thoughts of possibility, realizing actions courting all the difficulty,
and how things changed as Camper grew more prominent. He explains why Lowry sang,
never gonna go back to the rat and play another mafia show again.
He offers his perhaps surprising choice for his favorite Camper album, and he tells of his work with Sparkle Horse, the Urison Space Collective, and other projects, and what he's been doing in Sweden. Does Siegel think Camper could record another album or tour again? Or is this it? Siegel is bursting with creativity on stage and off. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Jonathan Siegel. I just saw you guys in D.C. at the 930 Club. Even though I'm in Chicago, I did not go to see you at Riot Fest because I saw you were down for like a half hour there. And I'm like, no, you know what? I keep seeing Camper on tour with Cracker and you guys open and I don't get a full set. I want the full set. Who knows in these times, you know, you're in Sweden. Chris is in Australia, right?
David keeps saying that, you know, this may be the last Camper show ever.
I know.
So maybe you saw the last Camper show ever.
It didn't feel like it should be, but I know that it's difficult. And, you know, who knows what the hell is going on. Anyway, it was totally worth the trip. It was a fantastic show and lots of fun for me.
And didn't get stopped by military on the streets of Washington, D.C.?
No, but I saw a lot of them. And, of course, now back in Chicago, I'm seeing a lot of them here. And it's not even you know, there. It's the National Guard. They all have the National Guard signs on their back that say National Guard. And they're standing guarding the water by, you know, Georgetown, where all the tourists are going to start splashing otherwise or something. I don't know. And here it's ice and they're masked and they're going through Millennium Park. And it's just, you know, so enjoy Sweden.
Yeah. I mean, we have our own, you know, weirdos. Our own Nazi contingent of the government, but you know, there's below 20% still. So,
That's good. How is this trip for you for you know, coming over, parachuting back into the U.S. with your old camper? I didn't realize that Chris Mulla was going to be playing, too. So it really was like the old guard there. I mean, 40 years. I also can't believe that.
It was interesting. Well, you know, the first ones that we did were at the Fillmore in April, and Chris Mulla played with us there. But then in July, we did a couple of different things. We did Winnipeg Folk Festival for a few days and another festival in California. But Chris Mulla was not there. So we were actually, some of us were sort of surprised to see him on this tour as well. But, you know, that's good. It's good. He sings well.
Because he left.
He plays the accordion.
Did he leave after the third album? Was he on the third album?
Was he on the third album? Yeah, he must have been. He left after we toured with REM, which was like fall of 1986, I think.
Right.
So I think we must have been recording the third album or done with the third album at that point.
So I think I mentioned this on your Facebook page because you were talking about the biggest shows you'd done. And I think you'd said the biggest crowd was, you know, maybe this Riot Fest one. But before that, it was opening for REM. And it was at the UIC yeah. Pavilion in Chicago. And I saw that show. And I remember it partly because I hadn't seen you guys before. And I really loved it. And also because I remember, I think it was Victor, but someone was baiting the crowd saying, I know you're here to see REO. And people are like, oh, REO. You know, boo, you know, not REO. I mean, even though REO's from.
We kept that joke going the whole time because our manager, Jackson, his roommate, I think, was working for REO Speedwagon. So we had a ton of REO Speedwagon backstage passes and picks. So we'd hand them out, you know, like, here, you want to get backstage to see REO? And people would be like, yeah, that was funny. And one time we went on the REM bus. I think it was in Kansas City to go over to see Richard Thompson play. And
oh, nice. So
all these fans outside trying to get Pete Buck's autograph and stuff. And he's handing them REO Speedwagon picks out the window.
Was that kind of a welcome to the big league sort of thing for you guys touring with REM and playing in those big places?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're trying to keep up with guys that are, you know, sleeping on a bus overnight and getting to the next place while we're in two cars trying to drive really, really quickly. You know, the next day to get there. So it was a tough haul, you know, and realizing what they did and what they had to do.
What about playing to, like, you know, A, not an audience that doesn't necessarily know you, and B, just bigger room like that, you know, early on?
I mean, we'd been playing to audiences that didn't know us, obviously, for, you know, several years at that point. And we had our heckling situation down, you know, how we'd take care of hecklers and stuff like that and talk to them or invite them up, whatever. But it was impossible, obviously, in this large of a situation. And it was also really difficult to see what the reaction of the crowd was in some places. Like, I remember we played at an opera house in St. Louis, and like the proscenium of the stage went so far in front of us that we couldn't even see where the audience started.
Huh.
So it was sort of difficult to, like, are we playing to people or are we not playing to people? What's happening? You know?
I moved to Boston and I wrote for the Boston Phoenix. And then I saw you twice at the Paradise when Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart came out.
And beyond that, we opened for the DBs at the Ratskeller at one point during that period of time also.
Yeah, well, I remember asking David why he was never going to play another Mafia show at the Rat again, because right. so that was a reference, I assumed, maybe to that show. I'm not sure.
Did he tell you what happened?
I mean, again, this was like 1988 that I talked to him. So this, I got, like, all of this stuff, like, time just kind of like gets telescoped or something.
Let me tell you that story. It's really bizarre. Two or three of the people from our booking agency at the time, which were in New York City, had come up to that show because they also booked the DBs. It was venture booking, and they had the greatest roster at the time. You know, it was like all the great indie bands, Replacements and Minutemen and Meat Puppets and everything. You know, so it was just the greatest roster of indie bands. So they were there at the show, and I went up to get paid, and I went upstairs, and there's like, you know, the bodyguards surrounding the dude with the slick back black hair who's talking with a voice box.
That's right? What I remember David telling me about, the tracheotomy or whatever.
the tracheotomy or something. Yeah, from like smoking through the hole in his, you know, in his throat here. But he's like, all right, so you guys had 100 people on the guest list, so you're not going to make your guarantee. And I was like, our guarantee is like only $150. We don't know more than like 5 people in Boston. And he's like, you have a lot to learn about the music business. I was like, okay, never mind. I'll just take that $100 and get out of here.
Was that it? There was just like, yeah, we're not giving
that you. That was it. That was like, that was the end of the conversation, basically. I had told him, like, our booking agency is here. You know, the people from the booking agency are here. And he's like,
So that was it for the Rat. Well, you guys outgrew the Rat anyway. So you were born in France, right? But then you grew up in.
My parents were on sabbatical. They met at the at Madison, Wisconsin, as grad students, and so they were there working at some hospital in Marseille. My dad is a biochemist, and then yeah, I was born there. And it's, I mean, what's funny about it to me is that I only lived there for 2 years. I have no memory of it at all. Before we moved back to California, or moved to California, because my mom's family were German immigrants during the 1930s, and they're very, like, very German. And my dad's family were New York Jews. So when they got married, it was both families were like, "You married a what?" You know. So I think it was they had to get as far away from the East Coast as possible. So hence, I grew up in California.
Right. So were they at Davis then, or?
Yeah, they both taught at Davis.
When you started learning music, was violin your first instrument?
Not at all. Actually, I started guitar like 3 years before I started playing violin. I started playing piano, I think, when I was about 6, you know, after recorder or block flute or whatever. And then I started guitar when I was about 7. And when I was 10, I remember I saw Susanna Stein, who is a violinist who lives in New York City. She's a professional violinist now. But I remember I saw her at school playing Pop Goes the Weasel, and with the pluck for the pop. Mm. And I was like, that's a cool instrument. I'm going to learn that. So I started playing when I was about 10.
Did you start taking lessons like at the school or private lessons or?
Yeah. Yeah. We had a little orchestra at our junior high and our high school. And then I started taking lessons from somebody in Sacramento, I think, but I can't remember the guy's name. They're all mean, all those like old, really old school classical teachers, you know, they're really quite incredible.
When you started playing guitar, were you taking lessons for that, or did you just have a guitar that you were sort of teaching yourself?
Not until I was about 12 or 13, at which point, you know, I was like, hey, I want to learn how to play these Led Zeppelin songs or whatever. So then I started taking lessons.
So did you just have a guitar around the house that you started playing when you were younger, or?
Yeah, my mom had classical guitars, you know, had a classical guitar. We had 2 of them for some reason. I don't know why.
So when you started learning, were you learning more classical, or were you learning like how to play songs you like on the radio?
No, I was just learning. I was just like sort of like strumming chords with my hand, you know, like open, like without a pick.
So, and then when you started learning violin, you were learning kind of classical, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you learn violin, but I imagine that's pretty much it.
Like it's all scale. It's all bowing and scales. And then catastrophe struck at some point in high school, and I broke my left hand. And so
how'd you do that?
During that period of time, falling down in PE.
Oh, okay.
On the asphalt. And then I only played guitar then for a couple of years. So when I went to university at Santa Cruz, I was like, oh, I want to play in the orchestra again. And so I started taking violin lessons, and the teacher there was Roy Millan, who was the concertmaster for the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. And he looked at me playing and he just said, we're going to have to start all over. And so I had to start like learning bowing and doing scales again when I was 18. Simultaneously, a year later, while I was still trying to do that, Victor and David were like, had asked Chris if they knew who I was, because I was carrying a violin around on campus. And so that's when I started playing camper or with those guys.
So they were specifically looking for a violinist for this new band they were forming.
They had had a violinist over summer break in Redlands. Like there were several people that I guess they used to play with, or Johnny Hickman also used to play with from Cracker, because right. they all were growing up in the same area. Victor is like, I think 4 or 5 years younger than David, but still, like, you know, they were like the little punk rock community that hung out in each other's yards and jammed on whatever. And they had several different bands, the Estonian Gauchos, which was, I know Hickman and Mola were both in that. And then Sitting Duck. And then I think Sitting Duck became Camper Van Beethoven and the Border Patrol.
David had said that the Camper was basically everyone's side band to start off. It was not like the main band for him and all these other people. It was just kind of the side band that they were doing. And then,
yeah, he was in Box of Laughs when I moved to Santa Cruz, and he was playing bass. He was playing a fretless bass, in fact, in this punk rockish sort of band, art band.
And then some of the, and like Ice Cream Every Day, I think, was originally Box of Laughs, and Flowers, maybe.
It's a Box of Laughs song. So is Flowers.
Yeah. So you didn't know those guys from school, but they sort of saw you, they just saw you carrying a violin. That was like the kismet of it all.
Yeah. I was at College 5, which became Porter College at UC Santa Cruz. And so was Victor, and so was Chris Mola. Victor moved there, like, I think, 83, 82. I can't remember. I moved there in September of 81. David had already been there for a year, but he was at Kresge, which was up a college that's like up the street by a block. So we were all like West Side colleges, basically, on the UC Santa Cruz campus, which is like a giant wooded hill with colleges spread out around it.
So you've taken these lessons to learn classical violin. But when I hear you in Camper, I mean, I'm hearing all this Middle Eastern stuff. I'm hearing kind of, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, you know, on mushrooms or something. Right. I mean, there's like a lot of stuff that you're bringing in there that is not what I, you know, associate with a classical violinist. So where did all that come from?
I have to say, I'm not a very good classical violinist. Like, due to my left hand being broken and not playing during my teenage, for a couple of years during being a teenager, I think it sort of screwed me up. But I do play guitar. And at the time, you know, during the first half of the 1980s, when we were at Santa Cruz, I was being a music major. So I was a composition major, but that also meant doing a lot of electronic music and taking a lot of ethnomusicology classes. For instance, I was playing in the gamelan that was there. And these ethnomusicology classes sort of combined with the fact that in the early 1980s, there were a lot of disenfranchised kids in Santa Cruz, at schools, I think at colleges in general, who were trying to discover their roots. So there were a lot of these bands that were like, we're going to play Irish music because we're Irish, or we're going to play klezmer music because we're Jewish, or, you know, whatever, this sort of thing. And they even Kitka started during that time, which is a Bulgarian women's choir still going.
Right.
And so a lot of this stuff, a lot of these sort of ethnic influences were just around us or in ethnomusicology classes, you know, that, like, for instance, Abundance, the song Abundance on the second record.
The first song on it.
Is me trying to understand how it would be to play an African one-string fiddle.
Huh.
The notes that I'm using are especially for the opening, are just like one string, and then it's like an open string and another string sort of thing. So it's like the whole idea is like it's sort of natural intonation, you know, sort of in a just scale, and just trying to find notes going up and down one string sort of thing. But, you know, that's again our take on it. One of the things about Camper, they had come up from Redlands to Santa Cruz with a lot of these already sort of pseudo ethnic sort of melodies, like Balalaika Gap and Skinhead Stomp, for instance. And one of the things that we sort of, I think, aimed to do was, it was sort of unspoken until we analyzed it later, but we were not trying to get it right. We were trying to make a signifier of it, like as if 1960s television did, for instance. You know, it's like, oh, the hippies or the Indian music on Bewitched, you know, and it's like, it's the signifiers of Indian music, you know, or this kind of, or say klezmer music. It's like these sort of signifiers of klezmer music, but it's not really that. It's more like it's been filtered through our, you know, our American upbringing and our, you know, sort of adopt a culture around us, you know, that was happening with all these people trying to like get back to their roots or whatever. And all of these things were which we thought were all fake. And so we were trying to fake it, basically.
Well, part of what's fascinating about it is if you're trying to pin it down, you're like, well, this sounds like klezmer music, and this sounds like ska, and they sound like they make total sense together when Camper Van Beethoven's playing them. But I don't know that people had sort of associated those things together beforehand.
And like the Tex-Mex stuff, because we like sort of realized that there's a huge German and Czechoslovakian population that had moved to Texas and brought accordions with them. And so it's like the polkas then with the, you know, the Mexican influence on it ended up sort of having a ska beat, really. So we were like, oh, okay, that's ska.
So did they already have some of these songs when you joined the band then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They were already several months in, really.
Did you have a sense of what your impact on the band was when you joined? Because obviously you were an integral part of that sound.
I didn't really. I don't know. I mean, it's because partially because I was just playing these things and trying to make up these things that went along with what we were doing. But simultaneously, you know, I was writing music like songs that I was strumming the guitar and singing on, like what became the record Storytelling.
Right.
So, you know, I was sort of simultaneously going on a different path. And so it was like, again, it's like Camper Van Beethoven is like, well, this is what we do when we, you know, it when we have the time to do it.
So they already have all these little instrumentals and some, you know, songs like I assume like Take the Skinhead Bowlings by then. At what point did you kind of get more involved in kind of the creation composition of the songs?
Well, during the recording of these songs, I would say. Because, I mean, I was getting involved in making, I'm very interested in making things so that I am part of it. You know, if I'm in a band that's going to record songs or play songs, I want to be, you know, have my own sort of input so that it's not just like a generic guy who can't play the violin very well trying to play along. But, like when we decided to record in January of 1985, I knew Dave Gill from Davis, you know, who was the drummer in Game Theory early on. And he was the drummer in several bands that I played in high school because he was the best drummer around in Davis at the time. But he ran a little studio with Dave Millington, who, as an aside, is the Millington sisters' brother, those girls of Fanny, the band Fanny.
Oh, right.
Who were in Sacramento at the time. So they ran a little studio that was basically his garage converted into a place. So we went up there for one weekend to record and then a second weekend to mix. And during that period of time, like we had all like sort of worked out our stuff, but this was the first time that we had ever tried to do this thing where it's like the bass, the rhythm guitar, and the drums record at once, and then we do overdubs. We had never done that before. First of all, the overdubs were I had been working in the electronic music studios at Santa Cruz, so I was like fully aware of how to mess with sound. So a lot of those sorts of things, like on Nine of Discs or the super distorted, I think it's a violin actually, on Club Med Sucks and weird stuff like that was all sort of my additions to it. But I think looking back on it, if I have one claim to fame in the entire Camper world, it's that violin line that's the last verse of Take the Skinheads Bowling, you know?
Right.
And that when they were recording the basics for that, they were just strumming it all the way through. And I was like, no. On the choruses, you have to go da 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 da. Remember, we do that. And they're like, oh yeah. So that to me makes the song good. But they had forgotten that. And so, you know, David and Victor and Anthony. So that's my contribution.
In general, was it a pretty cooperative vibe among everyone? Like, you know, I mean, were you guys a pretty happy collective?
Yeah, for a few years there. Yeah, definitely. But then it started to get sort of more intense and more, I guess, real. And then David decided that he didn't want to work with me. Also, because it's like, you know, the music that I was doing outside of Camper was taking up time and was not interesting at all to him. And that was bothering me a little bit until after we did the last tour that I was on was in October of 1988. We got home in November of 1988, and Chris Peterson went off to Australia because his wife is Australian, and that's where he lives now. And I went to Indonesia to record Gamelons. And during there, I thought about what I was doing and blah, blah, blah. Storytelling was just coming out, you know, and or it was just out. And I realized, well, it doesn't matter because I will always make the time to do what I want to do on my own outside of the band. So that's fine. I'll just do whatever he wants me to do. But when I came back, then he came over and said, I can't work with you anymore. So I was basically out of the band at that point.
That was 1989. That was a surprise to you.
It was a complete surprise to me, yeah. And, you know, he made up some little excuses. It's sort of funny. He brought over this sort of small Dan Trang, which is a Vietnamese zither. He's like, maybe you can use this, you know? It's like, oh, thanks. But, like, he was like, well, we don't want we're thinking about moving in a different direction, you know, without much violin, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, you know, 6 months later or whatever, they hired Morgan from Harm Farm, you know, to play violin.
Well, and they had all these other studio people doing it on the record, too, so they clearly had violin parts on that.
Don Lax, actually. Don Lax plays all over, and he's a nut job. He was like a street musician in Santa Cruz. Really good violin player, but just like, you know, couldn't be pinned down sort of thing. We went back to re-record and also to play all of Key Lime Pie, so I had to learn all those violin parts that he had played. I think Morgan only plays on Matchstick Men and Flowers on that record. And Don Lax plays on all the rest. But when I went back to learn them, I realized what they had done is they had just recorded him wild, like improvising over all the songs and then just pieced things together and put stuff together. So it was really hard for me to learn, both because of the technique, because his technique is much better than mine, and because it was like melodically, it was odd to me.
So they're the first two albums, then there's the third one, Camper Van Beethoven, because of course you call the third album the third album's your self-titled one for some reason. Still Wishing to Choruses on that record, which also was on Storytelling. Right. So clearly that's one of your songs, and you're singing that. And it's got all these kind of, you know, funky, you know, meter changes in the middle of it. I mean, you obviously sing on songs earlier, like Don't Go to Goleta and We're a Bad Trip.
Right, right.
Are you writing those parts that you're singing on those other songs? Like, what's the... So were you guys, so how did it work? Would you like in David or just all of you just kind of co-write? Would you come up with songs together? Would someone bring in demos?
A lot of times it's sort of a rehearsal thing where like somebody has some riff or something like that, you know, and then you find something that goes with it. Like, for instance, I remember sitting in David's attic where we used to rehearse and writing Waka while he was just doing da 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 da, and I was like trying to figure out sort of opposite ways to get to those notes. So it's like where he comes from under, I go from over, and
right,
things like that. But like that's how we wrote a lot of the music. And at the time, like in November of 88, for instance, before I went to Indonesia and then became an ex-camper, we were working on several of the songs that ended up on Key Lime Pie. And there are demos of it that I played on at that point, like Humid Press of Days and All Her Favorite Fruit and some of the other ones.
Yeah, I think
they're completely different.
Yeah, for some reason, I was listening to the third album on Apple Music just in the car, and there are all these like bonus tracks on there, and a lot of them were demos of stuff that ended up on Key Lime Pie. So I didn't know if they were like actually from way back then, or they just kind of stuck them on that, you know, Apple Music collection of stuff just to... Because, you know, because you guys owned that and didn't own the Virgin ones. I don't know. So.
Right. Well, that's possible. I actually don't know why that would be. But the demos for Key Lime Pie were recorded in like November of 1988.
Yeah, which would make sense. I remember Humid Press of Days was on there, and Flowers, and Matchstick Men, which I'd seen you play live before then anyway.
You know. We had actually recorded Matchstick Men and Seven Languages for Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart. But we sort of never finished Matchstick Men because at the time we realized that Virgin wanted to use it as a single, and we didn't want our first single to be a cover.
Right.
So and another weird thing about this is, like, the way that I recorded it and the way that we played it at the time, which I cannot replicate exactly now, but was a specific effects chain where I had like echoes and then a phase shifter after the echoes. So, you know, it's like my violin is having this echoey thing that's doing this psychedelic phase shifting. That song and Flowers that Morgan played, apparently when they recorded it, you know, Dennis went back and listened to like how I had done that and then copied that effects chain for the recordings that are on the record. So that when I finally heard Key Lime Pie, I was like, whoa, they used my recordings, but apparently they didn't.
Huh. So the third album, and then there's Vampire Can Mating Oven, where Seven Languages originally appeared, and as did Never Go Back, which I realized sort of after the fact is like the 6-song EP with no violin on it. And I didn't know whether that was like a conscious choice, but I interviewed David like years later, and he said, you know, there's one Camper record with no violin. And I'm like, really, what's that? And he's like, Vampire Can Mating Oven. I was like, oh.
I had never realized that, actually. I'd never thought about that.
Well, you're the violin player, so you would have noticed it, I would have thought.
I would have noticed, but I mean, I played other things on it, but
sure.
I think that we padded it out later with things like some BBC sessions with like 6 More Miles and the Hank Williams song and some other songs that did have violin on them.
The CD, when the CD came out, it was Camper Vantiquities, and it was like the first 3 songs of Camper Vampire Can Mating Oven, and then a whole bunch of other stuff, and then the last 3 songs. But
right, okay. It has Processional on it, right?
Yeah. I love Processional.
That used to be a really fun song to play live. I think we were already playing it live by the time we were doing the REM tour, because I remember like having some really like just big echo in those big spaces to do interesting stuff with the guitars.
There's like a 30-second snippet of it toward the end of side one of the album Camper Van Beethoven, because I remember hearing that, and then it turns into, you know, other stuff. It's kind of, and so then when I got Vampire Can Mating Oven, I'm sorry, listeners, this is so nerdy. I just remember hearing that riff. I'm like, oh, this is the song that comes from. And I'm like, this is a cool song. It's great, great little instrumental.
That recording that we used for the other one was from the Ice House in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which was a great performance of the song. I have no idea if anybody has the whole recording of that show, but just a great recording of that song. It was one of the only times that we got to improvise before we started doing Interstellar Overdrive and things like that.
That third Camper record sort of seems like, it feels like sort of a transition record, because it has some stuff like Good Guys and Bad Guys that would have sounded at home on, you know, the major label records. And then it has, you know, some totally out there experimental stuff. It's got Interstellar Overdrive. It's got Still Wishing, of course. And then how did it feel at the time making that record? Was that sort of a pivotal record, do you think?
It was super fun because we were recording. We had started recording up in this town called Felton, which is up in the mountains above Santa Cruz, up Highway 9. And it was a really nice studio. It was just somebody's house, and so we were basically in the living room. You know, we'd set up in the living room and record, and then go into this other room that had the mixing desk and everything like that. And so we went up there a lot. Like we at that point. We're able to go up there like every week, or at least once a week, or every weekend or something like that. So we spent a lot of time working on all these different things and being able to, like, you know, work them out in different ways, rather than just like, for instance, for the first 2 records, it was like, record the song, get the song down, you know, and it's like, do it, it's done, you know, let's move on, sort of thing. So we actually got to spend more time on things finally by that third record. And that's why there's so much weirdness on it, I think, because we had more time to mess around with it.
Was getting signed to Virgin a good thing for Camper?
Oh, I'm sure. It was weird. I mean, I felt like it was good, but, you know, it's like it's such a, the music business is so bizarre. And, you know, initially, there were some other labels that we were trying for, and Dennis Herring was the producer was trying to get us signed to IRS because he was friends with somebody at that label. I can't remember what was going on. But then we ended up getting signed to Virgin and then recorded the all the basics at Ocean Way. So that must have cost like $1,000 a day at the time, you know, and it was just like, whoa, what are we doing? We're in this huge studio on, you know, on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, living in Hollywood for like periods of time. Greg and I had a little apartment in Hollywood where we would like live and then walk to the studio to do overdubs for like a month, you know. It was a very strange experience. But you know, good. And I would say, it was educational. It was educational in a lot of ways.
Did the band change the way it operated and put songs together for that album?
Absolutely. I mean, at the time, David was already starting to like limit what the band was doing by what he wouldn't do, sort of thing. Like he wasn't going to have any songs that I was going to sing anymore. You know, it's like, those are going to go somewhere else, sort of thing. And so, so he was like sort of, I think, narrowing what he wanted the band to be at that time while we're moving it. And he and Dennis Herring got along really well. And me and Dennis Herring did not get along really well because I felt like Dennis Herring was not a good producer. I felt like he was an engineer who had no real ideas about production and really just wanted to make it sound like the current crop of whatever was hip, whatever was happening then. And if you listen to like the original versions of it, not the remasters, but like the original versions of it, it sounds like it's fully 1987, you know, with the digital reverb on the drums and everything. And it's kind of a horrible sound. And everything that I was trying to get him to do is stuff that he did on the next record when I wasn't there. And I've even run into him like late, like, you know, like the dryness or the, whatever. I mean, different sorts of things. He even like later I ran into him. I was living in Hollywood in the late '90s and he was like trying to ingratiate himself with me by telling me what other ideas he stole from me. And it was like, that's not what I want to hear. You know? Because of that, I think that that caused a big problem because it's like David being, you know, the most important person in the band at that point had the ear of the record company and the ear of the producer, and he got along with them very well. And so it was like one of those sort of situations, like you better, you know, sort of fall in line because I was sort of becoming unnecessary at that point.
When I talked to Victor,
based on what they wanted to do.
Yeah. When I talked to Victor for this podcast, like a few years ago, I remember him saying like, in general, there was a lot of conflict between you and David at that point. Was that kind of the root of it? Just sort of the recording of it? Was it just sort of also the direction of the band?
Direction and what we were doing. I mean, it's like, I really wanted to be in a band that had more freedom, you know, and had more communal aspect of it. You know, I really wanted to be in the Grateful Dead, basically. And, you know, David wanted to be in Cracker and he got to be.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause I mean, I loved our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, you know, when that came out, I was just like, wow, you know, like it's so cool to sort of see the progression of, you know, the band on these four albums with this, you know, EP thrown in. And, you know, I love the songs on it. I love the playing on it. I was glad to hear you guys play Waka at that, the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was also like a really upbeat record. Key Lime Pie After You're Gone was a more downbeat record. I felt like there was just the vibe on it was a little darker. And
Key Lime Pie is actually my favorite Camper record. I think it's so intense and it's such a good record. And, you know, I didn't listen to it. I was so, so devastated by being kicked out of the band. And then, you know, when the band would like come to town, I would hide in my room and like not come out for a week in San Francisco when I was living there. And I was devastated by this whole thing. So I never listened to that record until it had been out for probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 months or something like that. And I was trying to get, I don't know, Hieronymus Firebrain off the ground or something like that, you know, that I was doing in the early 90s, which was, you know, it's not popular. It's just not, I don't do you know, popular music. So it's like, so that was really tough. And so anyway, I went to Barry Simon's office, and he was the lawyer that helped to get us signed. And he's a big music lawyer in San Francisco, still is there. And I saw the tape, the cassette of Key Lime Pie sitting there, and he had listened to the first side of it. And I was like, and he's like, oh, you can take that and listen to it if you want. So I left and I started driving home. And so I put it in the car cassette player, you know, as we had back then.
Right.
And the first song I heard was June.
So you're side two first.
Stopped. Yeah. And I stopped. I pulled over. And I just sat there listening to it going, oh my God, this is the best record. Like, I'm not on it. I'm not part of this. But this is like their absolute best music that they've ever done. It was incredible. And like the way it was mixed, the way that it was recorded, the weird violin things like, again, like samples of Don Lax had been, you know, sort of floating in and out of that one.
Did you let the guys in the band know what you thought of it?
Oh, well, yes. This is a sad story. I did. I sat with it for about a week, and I wrote a letter to David, an actual letter, you know, blah, 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 write a letter. And I mailed it to him, and I said, you know, this is the best songs you've ever written. This is the best work you've ever done. I can't believe it. It's incredible, blah, blah, blah. But the band had broken up at that point.
Oh, already? Okay.
No, that can't be right, because it's got to be 1989. But I think that by the time he got back from tour, after the band had broken up, and he had gone to like Morocco or something to, you know, on walkabout trying to figure out what to do with his life, and came home to find this letter, he thought that I was being sarcastic.
Oh, no.
So it's like, you know, so, but.
So did,
you know,
he respond, yeah, to you, so, as if you were being sarcastic?
He didn't respond. So it was, I don't know. It was not cool.
Wow.
Anyway, but, like, and Victor and Chris and Greg, they hadn't spoken to me because I felt like they had betrayed me essentially by saying, ooh, you're out of the band because we need to keep our jobs, sort of thing, you know? And so we became extremely estranged, even though like I was really good friends with their girlfriends, for instance, and, you know, their friends and their other friends. But, you know, I didn't talk to any of those guys for probably a good year or so until they had broken up the band. They had finally like had enough of how it was, you know, everybody was just becoming mean drunks and whatever. You know, at the tender age of 26 or 27 or whatever. And Victor called me from, I think Seattle, cause he had flown back through Seattle, and he was like, I'm going to be in San Francisco. I have a bottle of whiskey from Duty Free. We're going to sit and talk this out. So, you know, then Victor and I essentially like talked it out and became pretty good friends again.
Good.
Which was nice. Yeah. And then actually a couple years later, David did send me some Cracker demos. This is like probably 1991, maybe, I guess. He did send me a cassette with some like Cracker demos on it, thinking, you know, do you want to play on any of this? And I was like, yeah, I don't think it's really where I'm going, you know, or my thing at the time. And it's funny because it's like they were songs – like some of the country-ish songs from the first record. And it's like, I'm not a really good fiddler. I'm not really a country violin player sort of thing. But also it's like, so I remember one of the songs was called Central Valley Mud, which is the municipal utility district in Fresno in the Central Valley in California. But that song became something else later. Like I'm Waiting for You Girl, I think is the song it became. So it's like a lot of these songs were songs that were in formation at the time.
For you to listen to Key Lime Pie, the album that you're not on, and recognize it, you know, as like this is their best record, that must have been pretty rough for you.
Oh God, it was devastating. I mean, it's like I was just floored. I was floored by how good it was and how I loved how it sounded. And so it's like I don't know what to, you know, it's like I don't know what to make of this. I don't know how I feel about it. And it took me a long time to like sort of accept the fact that it's good, it's okay, and it's my band, sort of, but not really, you know. So
it was interesting. At the 9:30 Club, I was with a friend of mine who we lived in Boston at the same time. We grew up together in, you know, the Chicago area. We were living in Boston when I was working at the Phoenix, and he's like lives in the Baltimore area now. And I told him, you got to come down for this, because he was one of the ones I listened to Camper with way back when. And he was probably on All Her Favorite Fruit. And I sort of leaned over to him. I said, it's so cool getting to see Jonathan do these Key Lime Pie songs. And he's like, I agree. Right.
At one point, we made the record Great Songs of Enduring Strength and Beauty, the great sort of a greatest hits package, about maybe 15 years ago, I guess.
Right.
But we couldn't get the, you know, the rights to do the Virgin one, so we re-recorded them so that we would have the performance rights to our own versions of it. But in the process, Bruce Kappen was producing those songs, and we tried to make them as accurate as possible. And it was really hard for me to try to make, you know, like I said about how Don Lax had been recorded and how they had used the parts. It was really hard for me to learn. And also technically, like, very difficult for me to try to learn how to play the way that he had played, that they had used it on All Her Favorite Fruit and When I Win the Lottery and things like that. So I had to practice a lot, but also, after that, I went back to the demo tape and listened to what I had done, which was different, very different from what he did. So it's like now when I play the song, it's sort of a combination of those things.
Like some of the stuff you originally brought to it, and then also trying to make people think, oh, yeah, I'm hearing that song that's on that record.
You're hearing the song that as it was on the record. Yeah, because it's not as it was on the record. Definitely.
So what was the moment that you and David, you know, made peace and Camper was able to get back together? I mean, I know you did that Tusk record, but like, how did all that thawing happen?
Well, first, for the first 6 years of the 1990s, I was a bartender in San Francisco, you know, riding a motorcycle around and drinking heavily. And,
same time, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time. All the time. I mean, it was just, that's how it was. And I was playing in a few different bands, one of which was Dieselhead, which was a really great band with Virgil Shaw. And then Zach, who now plays in Dengue Fever, was one of the singers in the band. So I was with them for a few years. And at one point, Cracker were playing, I think, at the Fillmore. And Johnny and David came to see us play at some tiny club on Haight Street or something. And I was drunk, and David was like, oh, you're fun when you're drunk, sort of thing. And so about a year later, he called me and he said, you should check out this band Sparkle Horse that I'm working with right now. And then I heard them on KUSF radio, and I was like, oh, man, this is really good. This is really good music. And then he had given Mark my name. So Mark called me up and was like, hey, man, I'm finishing this record. It's coming out. Do you want to be in the band to go and to promote this record? And it was the record Good Morning Spider, the second Sparkle Horse record.
Right.
And so I flew out to Virginia, and, you know, that's where David was living, in Richmond, and his studio was there. So we were sort of going back and forth between his studio, and I'd see him and then go out to the farm and rehearse with Mark. And then I was on tour with Mark for about 2 years there in 1998 and 1999. And when we played at and at that time I was living in Hollywood, and when we played at the Troubadour, when Sparkle Horse played at the Troubadour, David was in town possibly producing Counting Crows record. I don't remember exactly why he was there, but he came up and we did a cover of All Her Favorite Fruit at the end of the show. And it was the first time that I'd ever played that song.
Hmm.
Really? I mean, it was the first time I'd ever played it live, really.
So, and David joined you on stage for that?
On stage with Sparkle Horse. Yeah. So, during that period of time, I flew out to Virginia at one point to play on a Cracker cover of White Riot, that is a song that Camper obviously had used to do and still does. the Clash cover. And they were doing it for like a Clash cover album or something like that. And so I flew out there basically just to play violin like I did on the Camper record. And we got along, and it was nice being in Richmond. Richmond was really cool at the time, I thought. And so then we started like, okay, now me and Victor will come out, you know. And that's when we started working on the Camper Van Beethoven Is Dead and the Tusk stuff. And like the Camper Van Beethoven Is Dead record is, I think, from 2000. And it's really weird because it's like it's made out of remnants of things that we had left that were either left over or things that we sort of made up off of riffs that were sitting around. And we told everybody that we had recorded it in 1987.
Right. I remember you saying that about the Tusk thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. The Tusk we, the Tusk one was even better because at that point we said that it was a Strokes drummer's side project, and we sent out unlabeled demos to like press and radio and stuff like that.
So whose idea was it to start recording as Camper again? Was that the sort of the three of you collectively? Was it David like, all right, I want to revive the Camper brand?
Well, first we were recording, you know, just these like sort of fun things like the Camper Van Beethoven Is Dead and the Tusk record. Tusk was super funny because it was like, I was like, we're going to do a cover of this, of the whole record, you know, all of it. So we had to divide it up and who sings what songs and, you know, get everybody. And we had to get Rope Greg in at that point to play also. And so we started sitting in with Cracker at some shows as the apothecary show, like the traveling apothecary show, you know, where it's like, here's Cracker. And then it's like, now we get these three guys coming out and now it's Camper Van Beethoven, blah, blah, blah. And so, we started playing again, in 2002, and that our first shows as Camper Van Beethoven were at the Knitting Factory in New York. And it was, April, I think, of 2002. I believe I was still in graduate school because I'd moved back up to the Bay Area to go to graduate school. And it was one of the weirdest experiences I think I've ever had as a musician because, you know, we had not played, we'd only played certain songs and only then sitting in with like the Cracker drummer and stuff like this. And so here was the whole band getting together in a rehearsal studio in New York City, in the meatpacking district. And we were like, what do we do? And we're like, okay, we'll just go through all the records, like starting at the top and trying to go through it. And by about three songs in, I realized one, I couldn't think about what I was supposed to do. I could just let my hands do it. And two, these were the guys that I learned how to play in a band with. It was like, I knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, it's like, I knew exactly what was going to happen when we were playing together because I was so familiar with how everybody played. So it was like, it was such a good feeling. It's like, oh, this is my band.
It came back.
And it came back and it was really interesting. So then we started writing for New Roman Times, which came out in 2004.
Right. Who was drumming with you at the time, by the way?
Chris Peterson did drum at that one, but then it was Frank Fanaro who was playing in Cracker, who was drumming with us most of the time on tour. But in the recording, we have Chris Peterson actually.
So when you were doing those original rehearsals and it was all coming back to you, was Chris there at that point too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Cause I'd seen you with Frank, on tour. So I didn't realize that I knew that he was on New Roman, but I didn't know who was in there when, because partly because I was like, oh, he's moved to Australia.
Right.
What was it like doing New Roman Times, by the way? I mean, were you able
that
to
was fun. We did it.
Was it more democratic at that point?
Yeah. I mean, because during the touring, we would talk about these ridiculous ideas and how, you know, the U.S. was splitting into multiple territories of red and blue. And
so far-fetched.
And we decided. Yeah, I know. And how each coalition was ruled by different warring aliens that were playing out their aggressive battles with utilizing human beings in America. I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, it's really fun. And we had this whole sort of storyline of the whole thing. And we recorded it at Sound of Music, David's studio in Virginia, in Richmond, which was great. I mean, it was just, we had great people to work with, John Moran and Alan Weatherhead. They were really excellent. Let's see. We used one of the songs from one of my solo records that I'd made at that point, a record called Edgy Not Antsy, the song Civil Disobedience. And so we redid that. But in the process of making it into a camper record, Alan Weatherhead, really, the engineer, really took it and changed it into something else that it hadn't been before. So that was really cool. It was really nice working with those guys, I thought.
So you felt like it was just, again, you were sort of back together as a band at that point. And it was a much, much better vibe and, you know, working together than it had been previously or recently.
Yeah. The only issue that sort of developed after that in the next like 5 years or so was the fact that almost all the time Camper had to play opening for Cracker. Like the tour was both bands. David, I mean, I don't know how he does it, but he was able to sing for, you know, two whole sets like that. It's incredible that he can do that. But it was a little frustrating for us, I think. You know, all of us got a little frustrated by it.
Because you couldn't do like the full set because you were the opener.
Yeah. Yeah.
I loved Cracker too, but I was always like, oh, I want to see a... And I remember you were at the... you guys did like a couple nights at the Abbey Pub in Chicago.
And
that was
like
just...
when it was really cold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I saw it. Must have been around the 25th anniversary because I bought the sweatshirt for it. But those are just, I think that was just Camper doing that. And I remember thinking, oh, it was such a treat to just see you guys on a Camper thing and not trying to combine it. I mean, the problem, and David's obviously the economics expert, it's just hard to tour everyone. But that's why I was just like, all right, I got to see it while I can.
And economics were, I mean, things were different during, you know, the first decade of the 2000s also economically for bands. You know, like we could, for instance, hire a bus on the East Coast to sleep on it overnight and go to from city to city. But I don't think that it's affordable these days. Like, I don't think that we would make enough money to pay for it. And I don't think that, you know, that it would be within our budget anymore at all.
Well, and the economics of albums obviously changed. I mean, New Roman Times was 2004.
Yeah, absolutely.
La Costa Perdida was 2013. El Camino Real was 2014. And, you know, just people see albums differently for whatever reason.
And those really didn't, like, El Camino got a little bit of tour sort of promotion, but... I mean, La Costa Perdida did, but then once we had put out El Camino Real, there was only like two shows promoting it, and that was it. So it was kind of like, and then it was back to David doing Cracker and promoting Berkeley to Bakersfield and things like that. So
right, he was doing these conceptual Northern Southern California things in both bands at that point.
Right.
What was it? What was it like, by the way, recording those last two Camper records? You know, they're sort of
it was very interesting because the reason that those came about was that Greg had gone, I think, to Virginia. Was he in Virginia? Yeah, I think he was in Virginia still. He wasn't in Athens yet. And they had worked up some ideas, like for several songs. And so they, and then came back, when we were in California, we were supposed to do like three shows, I think. And one of them was at the Big Sur at the Henry Miller Library, but it got rained out. So the show was canceled. So we hung out at my house at the time. I was living in Oakland, and we hung out there and basically just sat around on the couch for 3 days and wrote all these songs. And we just, like, you know, made demos of all these songs. And then we started figuring out how to record them. And we recorded, I think, almost all of the basics in either Berkeley or Oakland with Michael Urbano playing drums.
Hmm.
He's a very good, really incredible, you know,
he was the kerosene hat Cracker drummer.
Yeah. I mean, but he's played with a lot of people. He came out of the Berkeley playing with Bourgeois Tag, I think, and then played on all sorts of records. He played on, you know, Blue Guitar, the good Red House Painters record, the really nice one. He's played on a ton of records, but he played all the drum parts on both of those records. And it took us less time to finish the first one. And then it took us an extra year to finish the second one, I think. And, you know, at the time we were going back and forth, like sending, because at this point, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012, whatever it was, I think that was 2011 when we wrote it all. So at that point we could like send files back and forth, and everybody had Pro Tools studios and stuff like that. So
you recorded like basic tracks in the room together and then overdubbed by internet.
Yeah.
And both albums were basically written at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. But then sort of like filtered into their various different records in a way. Like, you know, as we're going through the songs, they sort of like came into this record or that record. And then.
Right. And I've seen you play songs from all those later records on some tours. Mm-hmm. This tour, it was just stopped at Key Lime Pie. Was it just sort of like, this is like classic period camper tour?
Yeah.
Plus you were doing the whole first album. So.
Right. It's because of the 40th anniversary of the first album. The idea was that we would play the first album and then we'd do bits off of each album in chronological order till Key Lime Pie. That was the idea of these shows. Anyway.
Are there songs from those other albums that you would love to kind of come back to?
Off of El Camino and La Costa Perdida?
Yeah,
definitely. There's several songs on those that I really, really like. I mean, it's kind of funny because it's like some of them, like I Was Too High for the Love In, which is fun to play. It's a little jokey. And Northern California Girls, which is, again, it's like it's a little jokey, but it's pretty fun. But here, like, this is a good example of like, you know, the divergence of our methodologies. Like on Northern California Girls, you know, it starts off like it's going to be some sort of Beach Boys thing. You know,
right?
And then as it goes along, it's like it's really sweet, and everybody has their parts. But then as it's going on the outro, I couldn't take it anymore, so I just hit the distortion on the on my guitar and was just like whammy barring the hell out of like some sort of bizarre lead going crazy after it, because it's like I couldn't take how normalized it became at that point.
Do you think that Camper could record new music? And if not, is that for artistic reasons or economic reasons or all of the above? Practical reasons because you're so spread out?
Well, I mean, the practical reasons are sort of moot because of the ability to do overdubs, you know, wherever we are. I record here all the time. You know, it's like I do a lot of violin overdubs for people or guitar overdubs for people right here in my apartment. So I don't think that would be the problem. I think, writing it might be a problem because we would probably have to be in the same place at the same time to get together to do that. And especially like all of us in Camper Van Beethoven, one of the things that's amazed me about this band is that all of these people have incredible ideas and they're incredible musicians, you know. After we did our camp out a couple of weeks ago in Southern California by Joshua Tree, where we had been doing a festival since 2005, and then it didn't happen for 5 years. And then we just did the 20th essentially anniversary of it. And then the day after that, we went to Redlands, where Chris Leroy and Maria Bagliant have a studio that is also a performance space. And a lot of fans came over there on Sunday afternoon, and I did an improv set with Chris Peterson, Victor Krumenacher, and Greg Leischer. And it's so funny to listen to it. Like, I just got they sent me the files for it, and I listened to it. I mean, it's not perfect, but the thing that's cool about it is that you can just hear that these people have been playing together, you know, and everybody is really good, you know, and it's really incredible. And it's a privilege to be able to play with musicians that are as good as these, because nobody has stopped playing.
It's interesting because Victor's now doing the Third Mind with, you know, Dave Alma and Michael Jerome, and, you know, that's an improvisatory, you know, explorational group. And you're doing, is it pronounced Orison Space Collective?
Yeah. The Space Collective is also improv.
Right. So I'm like, what is it about, you know, that's drawing, you know, I mean, on separate continents, you know, it's drawing you both to do these kind of more less, you know, 3 minute song, more of these kind of exploratory works?
I think it's the level of musicianship that we've attained in our, at the tender age of 60, you know, it's like, we're finally like comfortable enough to be able to like spur of the moment, manufacture music. And it's really fun. I mean, I would say like the Third Mind is sort of like my ideal for a band, you know, with like Jesse Sykes singing and then the ability to go off and all, and how good those musicians are is just like, it's phenomenal to watch them play. So that's like, if I were in another band, I would love to be in something like that, you know?
So if you move back to the West Coast, you'd be like, Victor, I want to join the Third Mind.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have me. I'm not good enough. I mean, they have Mark Caron playing guitar for them live, and David Immerluck is playing guitar for them in the studio. So it's like, those guys they're way beyond my ability. So it's, you know, I think, you know, they put up with me, but I don't think they would allow me in a band like that.
You have the creative juices like, that would Space work. Collective.
Yeah. Yeah. Orison Space Collective is sort of a funny, happenstance in a way, because I was looking for, before we moved over here to Sweden, I was looking for bands that I might like or might, you know, try and hook up with or whatever. And I found a few, and one of them was Orison Space Collective, and I really liked them. They're based out of Copenhagen. And when I moved over here, I discovered that this guy, Scott Heller, was an American who had put that band together. And we had met, because in the early 90s, he was getting his PhD at Berkeley, and I was playing in various bands, you know, Hieronymus Firebrand, and he used to come and record us all the time. And so he was like, oh, well, you should probably just come down and play with us. And so now it would be, I guess, November 2014 that I went down to Copenhagen and first played with them. And it was so fun because it was like, we just set up in the studio and somebody would be like, okay, we're going to start on B today, you know, and it's like, that's what we do.
So do you play guitar in there or violin or both?
Both. And in studio, I've played other things too, like organ or electric mandolin or theremin or whatever.
If sort of in the abstract, you had like musicians gathering together, would you instinctively grab a violin or a guitar to join them?
Usually violin, just because there's more guitar players.
Right.
I mean, it's like, I sort of feel like, I don't know. It's like, I used to think I was a better guitar player than I am a violin player, but now I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's like, I'm not, you know, like world class on any of those things, but I am pretty good on both of them now. And I can sit in with almost any kind of ensemble. So that's, you know.
See, I'm not an expert on any of this stuff, you know, but I love hearing you play, so I think you're pretty good. So what do I know?
But yeah, I mean, it's comparative to like, you know, people that are only violinists and only do that their whole life are, you know, they're going to get somewhere that I probably would have another 40 years to get to.
There's also a difference between, like, if you're a classical violinist and you're playing this, you know, Brahms piece or whatever, you know, you're learning a specific part as opposed to being in a band and coming up with your own part and mixing, interacting with the other people in that band and having it all gel and make sense together. Like, that's a sort of a different skill, right?
And I think like when I first started playing violin with Camper, for instance, and essentially with other bands after that, back in the 80s, one of the things that helped me was the fact that coming from a guitar background, I could look at people's hands and know what to do, you know, because I could just read what they were doing and was familiar with that. So I could be like, oh, I know how to make, you know, that chord or B in that key or whatever.
Right. So in 2023, you had a collection that you put out called Shitty Nuggets.
Yeah.
which was just songs you'd recorded during the pandemic. I love that you listed them they're in alphabetical order, because that's just where they were on your computer. Do you just generally write songs on your own, like, you know, at any point?
I do, especially like when I'm out walking the dog.
So you'll get things in your head and then do like a voice memo
and then have to come home and do something about it. And that, like, the Shitty Nuggets was all like just all of these sort of half ideas. There's not a bridge in any of those songs. It's all just verses and choruses. But it's like,
you're right. There's no bridges. They're that dumb.
Yeah. They're that dumb. But I had to finish them, you know, because it's like I have that weird OCD thing where it's like if I start something, I feel like I have to get done with the song. And I'm not like one of those people that's like, I know how this is going to turn out, so I can just leave it.
You know who hates bridges and almost never writes them? David Lowery.
Yeah.
He did during the pandemic, when everyone was trying to figure out stuff, he did a sort of an online kind of class through the Old Town School of Folk Music here in Chicago. And so I signed up for it, and he went on this whole thing about how much he hates bridges. And I was sort of going back thinking about, you know, Camper and Cracker songs and how rare it is, even though Matchstick Men obviously has a big bridge in it. He doesn't like bridges. So it was when you wrote that, I was thinking, oh, there's something you and David have in common, except you weren't doing it on purpose. Right. And he does.
Right. That is funny. And also, you know, it's like some of those great songs, like the Cracker hit Low. It's just one chord progression the whole time. The chorus and the verse are the same thing.
Yeah, there's like a whole category of songs like that. Like Free Fallin' is that.
Wicked Sweet Game.
Sweet Home Alabama.
Sweet Home Alabama. Yeah, exactly. It's like, but it's like some of those songs are so funny because, like David and I have talked about this before. I have a few songs like that. Like a record that I made about 12 years ago called All Attractions has this song called Hey You. And Hey You, I Know You Know Me. It's like sort of my little local hit, you know, where it's like every concert that I do, I have to play it because people are like, "Play, you have to play this song." But it's just, you know, C, G, A minor, F, like any other doo-wop song might maybe. But the thing is, like that, and when I was discussing this with David about Low, it's like these songs take longer to play than they took to write.
Interesting.
When you're writing it, you understand what it's going to be. It's like, oh, that I know the whole song now. And then you have to like sit down and actually play it.
I mean, one of the things I noticed with Camper versus Cracker also, which I talked to him about, was that like our beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart and Key Lime Pie, there are very few choruses on there. Like Turquoise Jewelry has a chorus, but most of the songs don't have choruses. Like Aya Fatima doesn't have a chorus.
Right.
You know, Sweethearts doesn't have a chorus. And then Cracker record, it's like big chorus after big chorus. And so I was just like, you had to consciously sort of shift how you're writing.
And in Cracker, a lot of times they would do like the chorus, at the end, like five times, you know, something like that, where it's like, it's just like, okay, the chorus, it's continuing.
But yeah, I find the whole chorus thing just, I mean, like even the Beatles, you look at like, you could sort of, there's like a split almost between like Beatles songs with choruses and without, like Let It Be, big chorus. Hey Jude, no chorus, you know?
Like, no chorus.
Hey Jude's the greatest song ever, but there's no chorus on it.
Yeah.
And they'll have a little tag or refrain at the end of it, you know, where they'll, you know, at the end of like a line. But it won't be a full chorus. So anyway, that's just, so yeah, no choruses and no bridges. So tell me what you're doing now. Looking forward to.
I'm almost done. I'm almost done with another record of songs that are really good, I think. I don't know what to do with it though. I mean, it's like, I'm just this week, a couple of friends of mine in California are going to be doing some backing vocals on the last like four tracks, and then it'll essentially be done. I'll mix it, and a friend of mine in Copenhagen is going to master it. But I guess, I mean, I don't really have any like company contacts or anything anymore, so I guess I just put it out on Bandcamp.
I was going to say, are there even record companies anymore? I guess so.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how to advertise anything anymore. I can say on Facebook, you know, hey, I got a new record, and then 50 people see it, and it's like, oh, cool, I sold 25 copies.
People do seem to know about Bandcamp, though. I mean, it seems like that's become a nice home for a lot of this stuff.
I like Bandcamp a lot. I do get a lot of music there. A lot of different kinds of music exist there.
Do you play everything on this album, or do you have like a drummer come in or something?
Drummers, Chris Peterson plays on two of the tracks. My friend here in Stockholm, Mattias Olsson, who runs a studio called Roth Handel, he plays on the rest of it. John Mullen from Eyelids and Decemberists plays a little bit and sings on a couple of songs. Kelly Atkins, who was the singer with me on All of Superfluity, which is a record I did for back when there were record labels, 2017, the London label Floating World put it out, and it's a double record. I think it's the bookend to storytelling, I think.
Oh, nice.
Superfluity. Yeah. But so Kelly Atkins sings in Kitka. She's one of the heads of the Kitka choir in the Bay Area. And she just took it and ran with it and you know, made multiple vocal parts to like fill out these songs. And that was really, really fantastic. She's done one on this new record. She and Victor and I have another record that is done now. But again, it's like not sure what to do with it, but it's very ethereal. It's very Cocteau Twins, but acoustic.
So you recorded an album with Victor and this other person, and
my wife's family has a like an old farmhouse out in the country here in Sweden, and it has an extra little house that I guess used to belong to a lady who kept goats, you know, and she and her goats slept in this place, but now it's like it's just a birch room, basically like a one room sort of little tiny cabin or something like that. But I do a lot of recording out there in the summertime, and Victor came out there, and he and I just played acoustic guitars and just improvised a lot of stuff. And then Kelly again took it
nice,
and made it into something amazing. It's called The Ask. But I it's like, I don't know when this is going to come out or how this is going to come out.
Well, keep us posted for sure. Yeah, and would you come over to the U.S. to perform any of the stuff, or is that just too difficult?
I hope so. I mean, but again, it's not a financial reality. You know, it's like I would come over to the U.S. to see people and to see my brother and my dad and Victor and whomever. So it's like if I were going to come over, I would definitely try and do some concerts.
Nice. Also. In general, like going back and doing that whole first album and, you know, the other camper songs, like what was like, you get back on the plane, you come home, aside from having a cold, like what was that experience like to sort of go back into that music? Like, what did you learn anything from the work you'd done just from revisiting it the way you did on this tour?
I did. It was interesting because again, it's like going back to how I played 40 years ago. So it's like, I don't even play violin that way really anymore. And it was like some of those even simple things are like, say, Where the Hell is Bill? Where I'm just doing chords on the violin. You know, I'm doing like two note chords, like of fifths and sixths. And I was like, oh my God, I have not had to tune chords like this for a while, you know? So I've mostly been playing sort of single note stuff. And so it was interesting because it was like, obviously, what I was doing at the time was utilizing something to tune off of, like a one of the strings, and then tuning the other note to that string, so that I would know that I was in tune, you know, at the time. So it was really interesting, and also like trying to relearn Vladivostok, I couldn't do it. I was like, I barely play that fast, and I don't know what my like methodology was for, like, I obviously had some sort of idea of there are four different sort of like it's section A, section B four times. And on the section B, I was doing these like wild violin things. And I had some sort of idea of like how it develops over four of them, but I couldn't recreate it. You know, I had to like make up something else really. Wow. It was very interesting.
But it's kind of like when you're a writer and you go back and read something that you wrote when you're in your 20s or something like that. Like sometimes you're just like, oh, I'm afraid to go back. And sometimes you're like, oh, this was really good. I would imagine you had more of the latter reaction to this. Like, oh, this was really good.
It's nice. I mean, it was really cool. And it was really funny doing the whole record in order, because then, like, you realize, for instance, Border Ska and Yankee Go Home are both sort of like that Tex-Mex polka ska stuff. And they're both right near each other. And then, like, Vladivostok and Skinhead Stomp are both that sort of, like, Eastern European stuff. And they're both right next to each other. It's like, why didn't we, like, switch these things around?
Right. And I always thought Border Ska was the first song and then Lassie. But,
well, that was because when we sent the tape to Bruce Leicher, who was, IPR Records, our first label, which probably Victor told you about his relationship with Independent Project and how they ended up being our label for that. But we sent him the tape with Lassie as the first song, and he switched it around.
What?
Yeah. So we didn't know until we got the records, you know? And then we're like, oh, that's weird. It starts with Border Ska instead of Lassie. So we switched it back recently.
I know, because I remember the CD, it was sort of flip-flopped, and I was like, which one's right? You know, and I assumed Border Ska was right, because that's the one I got used to. But then it sounded great starting the concert with Lassie. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It was really great seeing you and hearing you play live recently. I hope we're able to do it in this continent or that continent.
It's such a pleasure to play with those guys, especially after, you know, doing it for so long. And, you know, they're all really good. So it's really fun. You know, it's like, I remember in 2019, before the pandemic, the last time that we played, for instance, at the 930 Club, I remember just like looking at us playing and thinking, God damn, we are really doing it. We're really doing it well, you know? And so it was fun to come back to the 930 Club and, you know, do it again.
That's it for episode 199 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Jonathan Siegel for digging into his work with Camper Van Beethoven and beyond, and for creating so many musical highlights over the years. Go to jonathansiegel.com to hear, buy, and learn more about his music, solo and with groups such as the Urson Space Collective. He also has a Bandcamp page, jsiegel.bandcamp.com. You can follow him on Instagram as well, at jesiegel. Also check out Camper Van Beethoven at campervanbeethoven.com and get up to speed on their albums, starting with the 40th anniversary edition of the debut, Telephone Free Landslide Victory. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who would never be accused of being a bad trip. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And I'll give you a shout out like I did with Hank Neuberger at the top of this episode. You can give $24 or whatever you like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.